Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Jacqueline Woodson has written over 30 books, mostly for kids and young adults. She writes about family and friendship, love and loss, all the while consistently and deeply examining the concept of race and identity in this country. She's built a career on communicating with kids through stories. So how is she processing this moment in America right now, and how can we talk to our kids about it? And joining me now from New York City is Jacqueline Woodson. She's an acclaimed children's book author. Her books include Harbor Me, Brown Girl Dreaming, The Day You Begin, After Tupac and Dee Foster, and Miracles Boys. She's the 2020 recipient of the Hans Christian Andersen Award, the first American author to receive the honor in over 20 years. And among other awards, she's received the Kurt Vonnegut Award, 4 Newbery Honors, 2 Coretta Scott King Awards, the Langston Hughes Medal, and a National Book Award. And Jacqueline Woodson, it's a great honor and a great pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It really is. And I wanted to start off by talking to you about the virtual Kid Lit rally for Black Lives Matter, which just happened recently. You helped organize it. It was a 2-hour event, and it aimed to both empower and educate children about race and racism and provide a safe space for conversations about how parents and teachers can talk to young people about it. Tell me how you thought about this event and why it was important to set it up.
I think it was important for us to set it up. I organized it with Jason Reynolds and Kwame Alexander, was because we felt like young people were getting left out of the conversation. And we, because we're in touch with them and we see them, we see their fear, we see their confusion around this. And because we primarily write literature for young people, we knew that we could have a meaningful and thoughtful conversation with them through the platform of a rally. And so we started organizing, started getting other writers together. And it had originally been planned that we would just do this 2-hour rally, but then eventually we put it up online for people to continue to watch whenever they need it to.
It's really an amazing thing to watch. I guess you had some 14,000 people who logged on, and of course it lives on. You can watch it right now. But an amazing response. What did that tell you? What did you hear, I guess, from the young people in what it says about this moment that we're in?
It says that people, to me, are willing to learn, are willing to listen, are hungry for information about how to move through this moment. It was gratifying to see so many parents watching it with their kids. And we set it up so that the early part was directed at the young people and the later part was directed at the educators and caregivers. And it basically told us what we already knew, that we need to be having this conversation continuously. And we need to be having it on multiple platforms for multiple audiences so that the change can happen on a major level.
Yeah. I want to play a clip of you, actually, if you don't mind, just because I loved the way you addressed these kids and fellow artists and authors and publishers, because you really gave kind of a history lesson that puts the current moment, I think, in a really important context, and in a context that I think becomes understandable for young people. So here's a small snippet of what you had to say.
This country has not always done the right thing. From enslavement, where Black people were sold and used for free labor and separated from their families, and children were separated from their mom, like all of that. That was a mess. That was this country. To having kids, little kids, work in factories instead of going to school. That there was something wrong with that, and we fought against it. Again and again, there has been unfair stuff that children have had to fight against. And the people marching and fighting and trying to change the world weren't just doing it for themselves. They were doing it to make the world better for all of us.
So that's a segment, a clip from Jacqueline Woodson, the author Jacqueline Woodson, who helped organize the Kid Lit rally for Black Lives earlier this month. And Jacqueline, I'm just struck by the way you put the current moment in a sort of broader historical context. Tell me your thinking about that in terms of explaining this moment to kids.
We have to understand that nothing happening ever happens in a bubble. It's all part of something that happened before. And I think it, and I think that helps us understand that this is not new. And so I think kids don't always get a lot of the truth about American history in schools and at their dinner tables. And I wanted to break it down so that they could see themselves inside this history and understand how we got to this place. So I'm always thinking about the historical perspective of whatever moment we're in, and the way history tends to repeat itself, and the way, in order to break that cycle, we have to know the past.
Mm-hmm. Is there something, I mean, I sort of feel two ways about this. I mean, on the one hand, we've been here before. This has happened to us before. This has happened for a long, long time. Can lead to a sort of sense of discouragement, but I guess it also leads to a sense of comfort in some way, in that we've gotten through it before, we'll get through it again. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, the key is survival, right?
Yeah, right.
And I think about how people of color, primarily Black and brown folks, came here, and we weren't meant to survive, right? We were meant to work until we died, produce other enslaved people who worked until they died. We weren't meant to become teachers and lawyers and presidents and writers and, you know, and reported all the ways that we exist in the world. And just knowing that small bit that we have inside of us, this survival mechanism, is really important. And I think that's really important for all people to know, right, about themselves, as a means of like, yeah, we're in a moment and we can move through this moment because people have moved through moments similar or worse before. You know, this is not the first pandemic. This is not the first revolution. This is not the first civil rights movement. So, and knowing that, yeah, it's hard, it's a struggle, and the struggle continues. And each time we become a little better off because of the struggle.
Mm, important perspective. Jacqueline Woodson is with us. She is the author of over 30 books, picture books, young adult books, and a few adult books as well. Listeners, we want you to join the conversation. Tell us how you're talking with your kids about what we're going through in this country right now, with Black Lives Matter, the protests, even the pandemic. How are your kids taking it all in? How are you explaining this moment to them? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. One of the things that you talked about at the Kid Lit rally is that it was your own experience when you were a child, for part of your childhood in the South, growing up during, or as a little child, during the civil rights movement. So what did you understand about that moment, those protests, when you were a kid?
I think the main thing that I understood was that I was cloaked in love, and that I was protected, and that my family had my back. And so I existed inside a bubble, inside a revolution, right? And I knew that things were going on. I knew that changes were coming and that they were scary. I knew that I knew about the kids getting fire hosed. So I had like snippets come in, but the constant message was, you're going to be all right, Jackie. You're going to be all right. So looking back on it from this adult perspective, it was like, wow, I lived through that. Like, you know, I was a conscious human being through that, and I'm okay. But that's my memory of it.
This idea of being safe, of feeling safe, of feeling loved in the midst of this kind of turmoil strikes me as so, so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. And I think what's important. I'm sure my mom, I'm sure my grandma, I'm sure uncles and cousins and aunts were afraid, but what they didn't pass on to me was that fear. And I think, and there was also a candidness about the way we spoke about things. I mean, and Black homes and Black and brown homes, we can't avoid talking about race. You know, it's a life or death situation. And so growing up, knowing, seeing that bravery, seeing that, like, I'm sure they were afraid, but that wasn't what got messaged to me.
Hmm. One of the messages that you deliver is this decision to be anti-racist. What does that mean?
Is it a decision? I think I can't imagine not being. I can't imagine not doing the work to change the world, because if we don't do it, who will? But also it's how I was raised. You know, I was raised with this idea of impacting a greater good. It wasn't just about me. Like, nothing is just about me. It's about what I'm going to leave behind. It's about who I'm going to help lift up. It's about how the world is going to be changed because of the work I've done individually and collectively. So, and anti-racism, it's kind of a no-brainer. Like, racism should not exist. So what's the work we have to do to make it not exist anymore? And in a country that was built on racism, right? So right. It's a huge amount of work to be done. And of course, it's not just Black and brown people who should be doing it, because we didn't invent it. right. You know, and it's the work of the allies and the allies understanding why this work is important, because it's not just impacting Black and brown people, it's impacting all people. And so it was never a question for me.
Listeners, tell us how you're talking with your kids about what we're going through in this country right now. We're talking with the author Jacqueline Woodson. She's written wonderful books for kids and young adults, and we're asking about how to help our children process this moment in America. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking with author Jacqueline Woodson about the pandemic, the protests, and this moment in America. She's an acclaimed children's and young adult book author who's written over 30 books. She's won lots of awards for her writing. She's the author of books such as Brown Girl Dreaming, The Day You Begin, Harbor Me, Feathers, Show Way, and Miracles Boys. Her picture book, The Day You Begin, has been at the top of the New York Times bestseller list for many weeks. And Jacqueline, I'd love if you could do a short reading for us. I wanted to ask you if you could to do that reading from the beginning of your 2014 book, Brown Girl Dreaming, your memoir, in which you look back at your childhood living in both South Carolina and New York in the 1960s and 70s.
Sure. I am born not long from the time or far from the place where my great-great-grandparents worked the deep, rich land, unfree, dawn till dusk, unpaid, drank cool water from scooped-out gourds, looked up and followed the sky's mirrored constellation to freedom. I am born as the South explodes, too many people, too many years, enslaved, then emancipated, but not free. The people who look like me keep fighting and marching and getting killed so that today, February 12, 1963, and every day from this moment on, brown children like me can grow up free, can grow up learning and voting and walking and riding wherever we want.
That's Jacqueline Woodson reading from her 2014 book, Brown Girl Dreaming. Jacqueline, it's so beautiful. I wanted to ask you, when you were a child in the South, what was the state of segregation in the South that you lived in as a child?
I lived in Greenville, South Carolina, and I lived in the community called Nickeltown, which was an all-Black neighborhood. And even deep into the 70s, when we go back and forth, my grandmother would take us to the back of the bus. I mean, there was still a serious segregated South happening through, I would say, to the mid-70s. And even though it wasn't, of course, written into law anymore, it was the kind of code of the of Greenville at that time.
And how did your, you were living there with your mother and your grandmother, if I have that correctly, right?
Uh-huh, and my grandfather.
And your grandfather. How did they explain segregation to you? And what did they explain, if anything, about what was dangerous about it?
You know, I don't remember too much talking about segregation. It just was. It was just what it was. I mean, the same when I came to New York City and we lived in Bushwick and it was the edge of white flight, you know, white folks were moving out and it was a Black and Latino community. That was our neighborhood. Ridgewood was predominantly Italian and Polish and Irish, and Bushwick was predominantly Black and Latino. And there, that wasn't what we talked about. You know, this was our neighborhood. These were our people. It was more about the danger of going into white neighborhoods. It was more about the mistreatment of white people against Black people and what stores we should and shouldn't go into because the people in there were racist. Like, you know, my grandmother, we didn't go into the dime store, which I think might have been a Woolworth. She's like, you know, they follow you around in there. We're not going to give them our money. And it was just kind of matter of fact, this is how we do it. You know, if they're not going to treat us fairly, then we are not going to give them our money. And so that's what I understand. It's like, this is how you do it.
Jacqueline, we've got some callers on the line. We've got some questions for you. Let's go to Carol, who is calling from Norton, Massachusetts. Carol, you're on the air with Jacqueline Woodson. Go ahead. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Jacqueline. I'm a big fan. Thanks, Carol. I actually teach at Lesley University in the Graduate School of Education, and I'm currently teaching an online course right now. It actually is ending this week in the Master's of Elementary Education, and ironically, I say serendipitously, I was planning to assign the other side this week and possibly read it aloud to my students on a Zoom call as a great follow-up to what we've been all talking about. So growing up in the East New York section of Brooklyn in the 50s and 60s, it was very natural for me to be friends with children of all shapes, sizes, and colors. Never really made any difference to me. But, of course, that's not the case for everyone today. And I'm hearing a lot online and even on NPR about white people not wanting to be friends with Black people and people of color, and I just take exception to that. It's been my life's work and my life's whatever. So I was wondering if you would be willing to discuss the meaning of the other side that it has for you and how you might be able to use it in the classroom or with young children as a way to discuss this subject. And thank you so much. And I hope to meet you in person someday.
Carol, thank you so much for the call. Jacqueline, go ahead.
Sure. Thanks so much, Carol, echoing Anthony, and thanks for your question. I think the other side is a very accessible text. It's the story of a Black girl and a white girl who live in a town that is literally a fence separates the town, a literal fence separates the Black side from the white side. And each child's parent tells her the other side is dangerous, to not go to the other side. And it's a book about children and activism and about how sometimes we have to question the rules that are in place and change them ourselves or figure out ways around them. It's actually a book I wrote in the 90s, and it's actually based on my experience in Park Slope, Brooklyn, believe it or not. I mean, I don't think that's too hard to believe. I think a lot of times we tend to believe that New York is this huge melting pot, but it's very segregated. We know it has the highest has the largest amount of segregated schools in the country. So when I wrote The Other Side, I based it on the fact that I lived in a neighborhood where one of very few families of color on our block. And also, as you move through the neighborhood, there are blocks where no people of color live on, and blocks where, that are all people of color. So, and then when Evie did the illustrations, he set it back in the past. And I was really cranky about that. and eventually, I realized that he had given me a gift, because I think this country is much more comfortable about talking about segregation as a thing of the past, as opposed to talking about what's happening now. And for me, it became a doorway to talking about the present by starting with the past. So I tweaked the book a little bit. I wanted to make sure both girls were equally empowered. I think a better book for this moment actually is Each Kindness, because I think that's one of the things that we're struggling with in this country right now, is how to be kind on social media, how to be kind in person, how to just talk to people so that they're able to hear us without rage. And I think you can get points across that are very angry points, but you can get them across with kindness. So that's my saying about The Other Side.
Interesting. I'm intrigued by what you said about teaching kindness and trying to project kindness on social media. That's a challenge, though. It can be. I mean, respond to this idea that social media seems like such an incubator, in a way, of rage mm-hmm. and extreme mm-hmm. and how we need to sort of be aware of that and, I don't know, help our kids navigate that.
Yeah, I always say, before you send out a text or a tweet, imagine it coming to you and how you would feel getting that, right? And so you hold up that mirror to your actions. And I think it makes you think. I think even if you took 10 minutes and reread and revised, you can say something that has the same impact, but is said with love. And because the truth is, I know this sounds so remedial, but if we're going to do this work together, we have to be kind. That's all there is to it.
Amen. Yeah. Let's go to Kay, who's calling from Decatur, Georgia. Kay, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hey, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say, I have a grandson who's currently 8 years old, and we ended up having to have the talk with him when he was 4 years old. His mom had been a victim of identity theft, and so a judge had given her paperwork to keep in her car at all times because the person was still using her name. And had a car accident at Walmart, of course you call the police. And when the police came, they ran her license, and the girl is a criminal using her name. So, the officer, of course, said, put your hands behind your back. And she says, oh, I'm a victim of identity theft. Please look behind my car seat. I have the paperwork. He would not do it. He put her in handcuffs. He almost threw her in the car. People were filming. And my grandson was in the car with his mom, and he's like screaming and crying. So my daughter called out my phone number. The person called me, said, look, here's what's going on. So, of course, I'm zooming to get to them. And all of it could have been settled had he just looked behind her seat and saw the court paperwork. So because it was such a commotion, the supervisor came out. The supervisor did listen to my daughter, did pull the paperwork out, did see that it was not her. But what happened to my grandson is he was terrified.
Of course.
I had to keep him. We couldn't send him to school. Every time he saw police, he was ducking behind me. So we ended up having to have this conversation about people judging you by the color of your skin, that mommy didn't do anything wrong, that he didn't do anything wrong. And it just ended up, trying to explain to a four-year-old child, why his mom was treated like that was horrible, and it was just us having to find a way to explain to a four-year-old about racial injustice, and we still happen to do these conversations. So what I always do, I just tell them the truth. It's their fault. It's evil. It was evil when they did it, and it's still evil today.
Kay, thank you so much for that. And I'm so sorry that your grandson went through this, that your entire family went through this. Jacqueline, do you want to respond to Kay?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. I mean, bless his heart. One thing that I do love is how resilient young people are. And I'm so glad you're there for him, Kate. I'm so glad his mom is there. I'm so glad that the paperwork was there, because God forbid, we've seen what happens to people of color in so many of these situations. And it's terrifying and heartbreaking. I talk about it in Brown Girl Dreaming, my grandfather constantly saying, you're as good as anybody. You have a right to be here. You're as good as anybody. And just the fact that knowing that it's, of course, not his fault, that it's not his mom's fault, that this is just, it's terrible. And I think you're doing what you can, and it's amazing, and it's fabulous, and just keep loving him up and showing him the right way to be and the way to justice. I think there's the book I'm thinking of right off the top of my head. Well, now he's eight, but Ibram Kendi's book, Anti-Racist Baby, was a great book. And another book called It's Not My Fault, I think, which is about a kid who's seeing all of this injustice in the world and finally is like, okay, what am I going to do about it? I think that's the title. I have to look that up. But there are so many great books. There's a book called Stamped from the Beginning that Ibram wrote, but he and Jason Reynolds, who's an amazing writer, wrote a middle grade version. And it would be great to do that as an audiobook or to read that along with him. So he can, and he will, through that book, completely understand what happened and how amazing and magic and beautiful and strong he is.
Jacqueline, I want to ask you, you made the point earlier in the hour that black and brown people talk a lot about race because they have to keep themselves safe. You talked about this at the KidLit rally as well, the KidLit for Black Lives rally as well. How do we include white kids in the conversation, white kids who want to be involved in this struggle to be anti-racist?
The same way. About it. I mean, I think everyone needs to be talking about race. And I remember as a kid, you know, we got slavery, which people called it. I say enslavement because we weren't slaves. We were enslaved. Mm-hmm. And to call people slaves takes the onus off the people who wanted to own black and brown bodies. So, I mean, starting with talking about the history of enslavement and white folks wanting to own black and brown bodies, and really having these conversations with your kids about the truth, about what white supremacy is and looks like, and the different roles that people play in it. And these are hard conversations to have, and I don't think you have to have them alone because the books are out there. You know, White Fragility is a great book to read. There's so many books that can help people have the conversations with their young people. And one thing they must not do is center black and brown folks as victims. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most dangerous thing you can do as a white person, as a white parent, because that makes us seem lesser than, that makes us seem like other. I mean, you have to have honest conversations about why this system is in place as it is. I'm always questioning people who live in very homogenous communities and don't even have a black friend they can ask a question to. Or a brown friend or a queer friend. Like, what is it that makes us live inside certain bubbles? Mm-hmm. So I think really starting to question that, really starting to talk at dinner. And if you have nothing to say, find a book to talk about that talks about these issues.
We're talking today with Jacqueline Woodson about this moment in America, about how to have conversations about race with young people. And our conversation will continue. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
a gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. On our program tomorrow, we're going to talk about Democratic nominee Joe Biden's, the presidential nominee, that is, Joe Biden's potential running mates. Who should he pick as a vice presidential nominee and why? Make your case. Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Again, that's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking with Jacqueline Woodson about this moment in America. She's the author of over 30 books for children and young adults, and she's won numerous awards for her writing. Her most recent book is Red at the Bone. Her picture book, The Day You Begin, has been at the top of the New York Times bestseller list for many weeks. And Jacqueline, we've still got some more callers, and I'd love to go to a couple right away. Andrea is calling from Baltimore. Andrea, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to hear you. I am, way up in age now. I was in New York in the 60s when they had the rioting and stuff like that. And, you know, it seems like it's one conversation with most of our so-called leaders, and that's like align yourself with the system and work with the system, like, you know, teach people about racism. Well, you know, I am not being sarcastic at all, but these people already know about racism because, like you said, they invented it. I want to know, what is the point of keep talking, even marching and protesting, when we see for years that this is not going to end, and the people we're trying to do it don't even want it to end? I want to ask you, don't you think we should have a different conversation now? They're not going to change. It's up to us to change. And by that, I mean exactly what I mean, a country within a country, a nation within a nation. I don't think that this is ever going to work, and we need to go to ourselves. Not only do we get it from the Caucasian people, we get it from other people. The more they look like them, the more they discriminate against them. Case in point, all the people who are in our neighborhoods, the vendors, they take all the money from us. They don't even eat in our neighborhoods. They don't use our stores or nothing, and they take all their money out. The nail salons is one good example. The hair things is another. You know, and all because we are so self-hating, okay?
Andrea, I'm gonna jump in because I think you expressed your question really, really well, and I want to give Jacqueline a chance to answer it. But the thrust of that, Jacqueline, what's the point of keeping this struggle going?
I think that's a really great question, Andrea, and I'm so glad you raised it. And I remember some of the struggles of the 60s, especially around free lunches in school and people marching. I remember that one of the marches was no money, no food, no school. And basically people saying, you know, we're going to get our kids out of the system if this system doesn't work. And I think that's what Black folks are saying now. You look at all of the, Hollywood Black Lives, rallies for Black Lives, all of these people, creative writers, television people, playwrights and actors are all saying, you know what, if this system doesn't get fixed, we are leaving it. And we are taking our Black money with us. And so I think two things are going on right now. I think Black folks are saying, we're going to give you a chance to get this right, but we're done. We are out. Like we know the power we have in this country. We know, you know, what a Black sick would look like here. And saying, you know, show up, don't just throw up a Black Lives Matter sign on your website, but show me how you're doing the work inside your corporation, inside your theater, inside Hollywood, inside your stores. And we do have to make those. I completely agree with you. I will walk an extra, 10 blocks to shop at a Black-owned store if that's what's going to make the difference, you know? And I think it's twofold what's happening right now. I think we are doing something that is different in saying,
You know what? But also look at the Montgomery bus boycott. It's like, you know what? We don't need to ride your buses. Go broke, right? And things changed. And I think that's what we're doing now. We're saying we're going to be out of here. We're not participating in these systems that have historically not worked for us.
Are you encouraged as well, Jacqueline, by the fact that a lot of these demonstrations we're seeing all across the country seem to be very multiracial?
What I am so encouraged by, and I can't say this enough, is young people. Mm. Young people are done. They are like, what? What is this country you're trying to leave us with? Like, you know, and this is across all racial lines. And that's what these demonstrations are looking like. They're looking like young white people and young black people and young brown people. Yeah, I mean, you know, and they are queer and they are straight and they are trans. And they're saying, you know what? It stops here. Mm. Like, it stops with us. Like, our grandchildren are not going to have this fight. So that's very encouraging to me. You know, to the young people, I say, I'm sorry. And to the young people, I say, I got your back. And I say, get out there and do your thing. And I support you 100%. So, yeah, I am deeply encouraged by what the young people are doing.
Good. Good. I mean, it's good. It's good to hear good news in this moment of deep, deep, deep challenge. I want to talk to you about how you talk to your own children about these issues. And there's a wonderful bonus at the end of your audiobook, Harbor Me, which came out in 2018. It tells a story about six kids who meet weekly in a room they dub the ART room. That's A-R-T-T, short for a room to talk. And they talk about their lives, everything from deportation to racial profiling. But at the end of the book, you've included a short Q&A with your son, Jackson. I believe he was 10 years old at the time. He's 12 now. Is that right?
Yes.
So I want to just play a short piece because it's lovely, and I loved listening to this. So here's Jacqueline Woodson talking to her son, Jackson.
If you were in the art room, what would you talk about?
Current events, border control, police brutality, stuff like that.
What happy things would you talk about in the art room?
How they stopped ripping kids from their parents.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, that's a great thing to talk about. I know a lot of grown-ups who say, oh, you shouldn't write that for kids because they're too young to hear that, and they should still be reading fairy tales, and they should still be living. What do you think about that?
That's terrible. If you're a kid and your parents do that, then when you go out into the world, you're going to barely know anything about what's happening.
That's Jackson talking to his mom, Jacqueline Woodson. Gosh, I just love that. There's another clip I want to play. But tell me a little bit about how this came to be. Did you just say, can I record you? I'm just curious about the dynamic that led to this wonderful moment between you and your son.
So in the my daughter plays one of the characters in the audiobook. I play the teacher, Miss Laverne, and Jax wanted to play a role, and he reads differently. So it would have been hard to give him the character of Amari because there are a lot of lines. So I said, how about this? How about at the end, you and I just chat, because we talk all the time. So let's just, you know, step into the studio and have a conversation, and we could talk about whatever you want to talk about. And that's how that happened. Mm. And he surprised me.
How so? What surprised you?
Well, he called me out a couple of times, because he was like, at one point I say, you know, some people have a mom and dad, some people have two moms, two dads. He's like, well, what about gender? I think he said non-binary people. What about gender non-conforming people? I'm like, oh, okay. So.
But I love this point he makes, that if you're a kid and your parents do that when you go out into the world, you're going to barely know anything about what's happening if you try to hold back and only sort of tell them happy fairy tales. I mean, that just seems like such a profound idea. And I think it's a mistake that parents often make with their kids. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, we want to protect them. No, don't let them know about what's going on. You know, let's read them another fairy tale.
Yeah, and let's teach them to be navel gazers. You know, I think that that is the thing. The one thing that people who write for young people do is we do it with love. We do it with care. We do it with hope. You can't write a children's book without having hope in it. Even if there's not a quote unquote happy ending, there has to be hope somewhere in that narrative to keep that young person turning the page and to have that young person walk away from that book feeling hopeful. And I think that to say, well, this book is
to real life for my young person is not seeing your young person and seeing how perceptive young people are. They know something is happening. They know the world is not quite right now. Mm-hmm. And to gaslight them into thinking otherwise is unfair.
Mm. Jacqueline, if I can, one more moment with you and Jackson from the end of that audiobook, Harbor Me. Here's Jackson with a question that I want to ask you, but I'm going to let Jackson ask you.
What drove you into writing this book?
You know how I always talk about I write because I have so many questions, not because I have answers. And I was thinking about all the stuff. I was thinking about deportation and what's going on with that. And what do we always talk about at home with the Nerf guns?
Don't play with them in the park, because a kid got shot by the police because he had a Nerf gun, but it was hyper-colored and that couldn't have looked like an actual gun.
So we get scared for you. And I think when I get scared sometimes, it helps to write about it and to create characters that talk about it, because it helps me to understand it more.
That's Jacqueline Woodson talking to her son, Jackson. Another lovely moment. Also sort of sad that, lovely. He sounds so ahead of his years, Jacqueline, I've got to say. 10 years old. I'm just blown away.
Yeah, he's an old man. He's always been like that.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No. You go ahead.
I was just going to say, it is kind of heartbreaking. I mean, I don't like guns anyway. We don't like them in the house, any kind of toy gun or anything, just because that's who we are. But there's always some auntie or uncle or dad, giving him some present that he's always wanted, and then they get in. But it is sad to have to curb the way your child plays. Right? We don't get to play for very long. So, but I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
No, you didn't at all. Jacqueline, what I was going to ask you about is, he asked that great question about what sort of drove you into writing that book. And you gave this really interesting answer just about how you're thinking about all this stuff and you need to write to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love it if you could expand on that idea.
I, as I said to him, I have so many questions, and I think we can kind of lose our minds a little bit with all of the information coming at us so quickly and no means of processing it. For me, writing allows me to process what is happening in the world, or what has happened in the world, and to get a better understanding of it through the writing and rewriting and reading out loud and researching and creating characters who can kind of speak a narrative that's part of the question and help me to see it better. It's complicated. It's hard to explain, but I think of someone like Tiago, who has he's from Puerto Rico, which makes him an American citizen. He has a monolingual Spanish-speaking parent that he has to translate for, and the hatred that gets thrown at him because his mother speaks this beautiful language, and the ridiculousness of that, and the fact that people's cultures are constantly getting called into question. And the thing about Harbor Me is, I started writing that book a long time ago. I mean, we've been dealing with mass incarceration in this country for a long time. We've been dealing with deportation in this country for a long time. We've been dealing with economic disparities for a long time. So taking those kids and putting them in the room to talk about these questions that I've always had, and that lots the kids have. Mm-hmm. So made sense to me.
I want to ask you about this particular moment, because kids, on top of everything, on top of these issues that we've been talking about racial justice, about the protests, about Black Lives Matter, they are also dealing with this coronavirus and lockdown at homes and away from their mm-hmm. friends and all kinds of challenges that are associated with that. What are you hearing from them about this sort of confluence of challenges right now?
Well, my son complains about teachers not knowing how to use Zoom. I think that's one frustration for the young people. You know, they're so ahead of us in terms of using technology. And here we come, we old folks, and we're like, okay, now we got to get on a Zoom call with our class. Like, how do we do this again? It's like, just get on the Zoom. So I see, I definitely hear the frustration. And the thing my son said the other day was like, I'm forgetting how to socialize with people. And that broke my heart, because it is, we are, you know, we're in our pods, we're, you know, doing our sheltering, we're trying to figure out how to stay engaged, but we're engaged with a screen at the same time telling them to have less screen time. You know, it's all of these, I don't know, kind of contradictions going on. And at the end of the day, they're like, okay, so when is this thing going to be over? At the same time, they're learning how to negotiate it. I mean, you know, they automatically put on their mask when we go into a store. And again, going back to their resilience and their ways of being able to kind of move like water with the times is always gratifying to me. Mm.
Is that the hopeful? What's hopeful about this moment? I mean, perhaps the pandemic offering them a chance, I don't know, to look up and see what's going on in their world, even though that sounds contradictory because, of course, they're staring at screens, Zoom screens and everything. But is there something hopeful about that?
Yeah, I think there is a chance for more. There's gathering. I mean, even the family gathering, getting around the table and having true thoughtful conversations with your family. I think in terms of even engaging deeper via Zoom, right? Knowing that when you see that person, you're seeing inside their house, you're seeing inside their living room, their bedroom, and you have another kind of understanding of them. I think people are reading more, people are talking more, and even the marches in New York, you know, people are heading to the marches and being allies and doing the work that needs to be done.
Well, Jacqueline Woodson, it was such a pleasure talking to you this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony. It was great.
It really was. That's Jacqueline Woodson. She's the acclaimed author of Brown Girl Dreaming, The Day You Begin, After Tupac and Dee Foster, the forthcoming Before the Ever After, among many other books. Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.